we invite people
of all backgrounds
to share their stories
through nuanced conversations
and forward thinking
and not taking ourselves too seriously.
Everyone's story matters.
Every voice is important.
Life is polarizing,
but not everything is black and white.
Come join us
as we fade to gray.
Welcome. Welcome, welcome to another episode of Fade to Gray. It is I, let me crank up that energy a little bit for you. It is I, the host, co-host of Fade to Gray, Omar Williams, here with my wife, Elizabeth. So hello.
Hey.
And our favorite Christopher Cody, Grace, down there.
Hey, what's going on?
Chilling like a villain. How is everybody doing?
I'm all right. I'm processing like several books that I'm processing several books that I've been reading, and it's kind of driving me nuts that I can't talk about that because they don't have anything to do with what we're going to talk about today. So I'm trying to pull myself together here.
Man, this is great podcasting. Yeah,
thanks I know, a lot, right? Elizabeth. Yeah, no worries. It's all good. Caste system in the U.S. You guys really got to read that book.
Well, I'm doing good, Omar. Thank you for asking. And I'm ready to get into the talk today with Sue. I remember Sue from episode 7. I think you'll probably talk about that here in a second. But yeah, I'm really excited to get into it about Israel and Palestine. I think it's going to be awesome.
Yeah. Suzanne was on for episode 7, which she did great. We did not. So we'll cover a lot of the meat of that conversation in here. She's kind of introducing what she does. The reason Suzanne came back on my mind this week was because I was doing a deep dive into some podcast about the Israeli-Palestine conflict. Somebody in our group, Joe, shout out to Joe, made a comment earlier in the week after I believe it was Israel. I forget who bombed who first earlier in this week. I'm sure Suzanne would probably let us know. But when that first, it was like Monday. So I think it was Sunday night somebody got bombed. So Monday he made the comment. So I wanted to know more because most of us, if you grew up in evangelical or even in America, there's a very strong pro-Israel political thing or within the evangelical church.
Zion, baby.
and so growing up, I always just heard one side of the narrative. And then it wasn't actually until I first met Sue, or we first had episode 7, where I heard a different perspective, and it really kind of opened up my eyes. And ever since then, I've been more open-minded to this conflict because I had no clue what was actually going on. Got a little bit of the history of the conflict, and then like early in the week, I'm like, wait a minute, what am I doing? I'm like trying to like get all these different sources, but I was like, I know somebody who's lived in the Middle East for 17 years. She's the executive director of Beirut and Beyond, which basically works with Palestinian refugees in Jordan and Lebanon. And she's here today with, and she brought a friend of hers who, well, they say they're not friends. We'll see how this goes. Steve Phillips, who is on the board of directors, I believe, with Beirut and Beyond, also a lawyer, lived in Cairo and has some other credentials. He's like apparently a nerd. So we're going to get an education today. And I'm very excited that Suzanne agreed to do this last minute. And yeah, what did I miss in your introduction there, Sue?
Lots. No. yeah, thank you, Omar. I have been working in the Middle East for the past 17 years in Palestinian refugee camps. And Beirut Beyond is an organization set up to benefit Palestinian refugees. In the Middle East, we partner with national organizations that are Palestinian-led and Palestinian-run, and we provide what they request, whether that be a project or manpower or finances. And in the US, we focus on education on Palestinian refugee narrative, which people have been very interested in this week, believe it or not.
I believe it. I'm interested, and I'm glad that you're here and educate us. So you say you work with Palestinians. So are you a terrorist then?
Wow.
First question.
Way to lead, Omar. Way to like get people like interested.
That's why she brought her lawyer on.
That's why I did bring
I can let her know if she can answer that question or not.
But that is a common narrative, though, right? You hear, depending on what news source you listen to here in the U.S., like...
Yeah, of course it is. You know, it deflects from the actual, what's actually happening on the ground. And, you know, Steve's here because he is, by all means, a geopolitical nerd and has a lot of knowledge of Middle East politics. But when you contacted me this week, I was pretty rough with you because you were like, yeah, let's talk about this and this and this. I'm like, nope, I'm going to talk about Palestinian refugees and what the core of this, which is the occupation. Because we're not, I don't think in the United States, we're not having the right conversation about this. I think that we're focused on terrorism or Hamas when we don't know who they are, but we're not focused on what the root cause.
Can we get some of these terms out of the way real quick? What the exactly. hell is Hamas?
Or what's the occupation? The first thing you said.
Sure, Steve.
Sure. So, you know, I'll try and compress it quickly, but, you know, in 1947, the United Nations decided that they were going to partition what had previously been British occupied territory in the Middle East called the Palestine Mandate or British Mandatory Palestine. They agreed to split that into two states, a Jewish state and a Palestinian state. They drew some borders up and they decided, you know, took a vote and they said, okay, we're going to do that. So in May of 1948, yesterday was the 73rd anniversary of it. The state of Israel was declared. There were hundreds of thousands of Palestinians who were forced off their lands in the ensuing combat. There was combat because, you know, five other Arab nations attacked, you know, mandatory Palestine and tried to prevent the state of Israel from being formed. They failed. And then Israel declared its borders. They were broader borders, more expansive than what had been prescribed by the United Nations the year before. But they held on to those borders more than they were allocated under the partition plan. And then in 1967...
Can I add something? Because I'll add the refugee aspect. So in 1948, when the state of Israel was created, you had a population of Palestinians that lived in Palestine that was 1.5 million. 750,000 were displaced, either forcibly removed or fled during fighting. So half of a population is now displaced. So something traumatic is happening, right? Okay.
Let me just ask you this real quick. During that 1948 Arab-Israeli war, did Jordan not gain Jerusalem?
So they took over the West Bank of the Jordan River, which had previously been in mandatory Palestine. And that included East Jerusalem as well, which is involves the old city that, you know, has all the religiously, well, not all, but has all the, you know, places that are most significant religiously. So Jordan took that over in that war. And at the same time, Egypt took over the Gaza Strip and they occupied those militarily until the Yom Kippur War the Six-Day War in 1967. In that war, the Israelis pushed out the Egyptians from Gaza. They pushed out the Jordanians from the West Bank, and they actually pushed into Egypt all the way up to the Suez Canal. They took over the entire Sinai Peninsula. In 1973, the Egyptians staged a surprise attack during Yom Kippur, which is the high holy holiday for Jews, caught them by surprise. And even though they lost that war in part due to some American air support that was given to the Israelis, that they then were able a few years later to strike a peace deal. And so in exchange for offering peace, they got back the Sinai. And since that time, Gaza and the West Bank have been under Israeli occupation. Then in 2005, the Israelis withdrew from Gaza for reasons we could discuss later if it ever gets important. But Gaza's about 70% refugees from what is now the state of Israel.
So the second major displacement of refugees happened in the Six-Day War in 1967. You had another 325 thousand Palestinians displaced. Now, 125,000 of those, like almost a third, over a third, were refugees from 1948. So they were double refugees. They were doubly displaced. And so the refugees that he's talking about, the population in Gaza has a population of 1.9 million. 1.4 million are registered as refugees with the UN. They are not from Gaza. They were put into Gaza. So keep that in mind. When people have conversations about Gaza, they never talk about that issue, that these are refugees, stateless. No. Sorry to cut you off. I just wanted to add those stats.
Sure. No, that's all really good stuff. And so with that too, and correct me if I'm wrong, like most of them can't leave, right? Because like they're trapped at all the borders. So like,
yeah, there's been a 15 year blockade on air, land, and sea.
And it's not to say that nobody can get out for any reason, but it's hard for Gazans to even get into a hospital in Jerusalem because they can't get the paperwork approved to go for necessary medical procedures often. So to get out of the country and get back in to really kind of travel freely is extraordinarily difficult. And it's just not even within the realm of contemplation for most Palestinians there.
Very good. I don't know if I wanted to keep asking questions or just keep giving us the education, because this is really important and really good.
So, okay. So let's go, let's take it now. Cause I want to talk a little bit about refugees. So right now, currently in 2021, you have 5.6 million Palestinian refugees registered with the UN in Lebanon, Jordan, the West Bank, Gaza, and Syria. Okay. You have 58 refugee camps scattered throughout the Middle East.
That's a lot to wrap your mind around. 5 million, she said, over 5.6.
So yeah, 5.5 million. So part of the definition for Palestinian refugee means that you pass your refugee status on to your descendants because you don't have citizenship. So we're talking 73 years of refugee status. Like, Palestinians are the oldest, and they're tied with Syrian refugees now for the largest refugee group in the world. So you're talking, I work with third and fourth generation refugees, that their grandparents were displaced, their parents were born in a camp, they were born in a camp.
And that's all they know. Wow. So what's that like then, working with them? Like,
yeah,
it's almost like a Stockholm syndrome thing, I would imagine. If that's all you've known was like the occupation, all you've known is being a refugee. Like, yes, you have hope for something else, but like, man, three generations, like, how do you still have hope for something different?
Well, yeah, I think let's talk a little bit about what it means to be a refugee and what it means to be stateless, because this is harder for Americans. Mm-hmm. Like, when you don't have citizenship in any country. So that means you are not afforded the rights of any country. You do not participate in the social, economic, political makeup of any country. You do not have a passport. So you do not travel freely. A lot of times, like in Lebanon or Jordan, you can get paperwork to maybe get approved so you can travel. But that's, especially in Lebanon, that's rare. You don't have a bank account. You're not allowed to own a business. In Lebanon, you're not allowed to participate in 70 different professions. You can't be a doctor or a lawyer in Lebanon if you're Palestinian. So those are some of the basic human rights. Did I forget something? Those are some of the basic human rights that refugees lack. And then when you think about 73 years of it, yeah, it's I know when I give people stats, it's overwhelming.
I have a question.
So the 5.6 million refugees, these are the Palestinian refugees. You said 58 camps across the Middle East. Are those 58 camps just the Palestinian camps, or does that include the Syrian?
Those are 58 Palestinian.
Palestinian. So that doesn't count the Syrian refugee camps.
Okay, no. And of course, in Lebanon, you do have an influx in Palestinian refugee camps of Syrians and of Palestinian refugees from Syria. So you have, they were displaced in Syria And now they're displaced again in Lebanon because of a Syrian conflict.
It's nuts.
It is nuts.
And the United States played what part in creating that?
in creating, I mean, that's a pretty heavy, complicated topic. You know, I will say UNRWA, which is the UN Relief and Works Agency that was set up in 1949 to address the Palestinian refugee crisis. They do relief. They provide services, basic services for Palestinian refugee camps.
Education,
healthcare. They are the only, one of the only forms of legal employment for a Palestinian refugee. They hire, I think they have it. This is before COVID numbers, guys, but it was over 30,000 Palestinian refugees were legally employed by UNRWA. So the United States, starting with Harry Truman in 1949, have supported. We've been the major contributor to funding. And that ended with the Trump administration in 2017, 2018. I can't remember which year it was. I think it was 17. Where they pulled all funding for UNRWA, and it was $320 million, something like that. And since then, UNRWA has been struggling. Now, I mean, I've been on the ground, and Steve can tell you as well, like UNRWA can do some good work, but I've seen a lot of corruption. As you do with UN agencies, as you do with NGOs, when you're working with that kind of that level of poverty. So, you know, the U.S. said that they were corrupt, all of these things. That's why they pulled it. I mean, it was political. It was to kind of erase refugee status because the refugees are a sticking point.
They were using it to squeeze places like Jordan, because they wanted places like Jordan, Egypt, and Syria to basically say, hey, well, nobody's taking care of these Palestinians. So there was a pressure move to try and get them to accept the Palestinians as citizens of their own countries. I mean, it would be like as if someone came in, if China came in and invaded the United States, and then, you know, then they put the squeeze on Ireland, you know, to make Suzanne and I and you guys citizens in Ireland just because, well, you know, you're
you speak English.
You speak English, you know. You eat pork.
Oh, that's crazy. And what does Israel have to do with all this?
Well,
aside from the fact that that's where they're originally displaced from.
Yeah.
I mean, the Israelites did have control over that land a long time ago. And then,
right,
of course, you know, through that land has been contested for centuries, right? Egypt
really
controlled
no,
it.
No, no,
Jebusites
no.
controlled it.
Nope, not really.
Didn't the Israelites originally take it from the Canaanites?
Well, okay. Let's go back into some more recent history. Let's only go back a couple hundred years. Okay. Let's do that. So Palestine was under the Ottoman Empire. Okay. And you had
for like 2 seconds
for like 400 years. So there's that.
A history nut, Chris.
So you had Palestinian Arabs, Muslims who are Muslims, who were Jewish, who were Christian, that all lived together relatively peacefully. So things changed during World War I when the Ottomans lost control of the Middle East. And Steve mentioned that it was under the British mandate. So if you've ever seen the movie Lawrence of Arabia, which is still one of my all-time favorite movies because Omar Sharif is amazing, but it still does that time period justice. Like the British asked the Arabs to revolt against the Ottomans, so they had another front during World War I, and then they promised them their independence, and that was never going to happen. So then Britain and France chopped up the Middle East into mandates that they then governed. Colonialism 101. So, where was I going with that?
The question was about Israel. So I think you were getting.
Yeah. So, okay. I'm getting there. but I forgot why I went off.
Century-old conflict.
That's what it is. Like, this isn't, everybody wants to talk that it's like, they've been fighting for, they've been fighting for thousands of years. No, this is the past 100 years when everything changed. So the state of Israel was created. And you know, those 750,000 Palestinians that were displaced in 1948 were never compensated for their loss of home, their livelihood, their land. It was just taken and they were not allowed to return.
And then their land was settled, quote unquote, by settlers.
Yeah, it was. And so part of you've heard the term right of return, right? Like, everybody talks about that, but nobody really knows exactly what that means. Steve, do you want to give the legal?
I don't know that I have that. Yeah. So it's essentially under international law, refugees from anywhere have the right to go back to their homes just by virtue. If you flee a war, it doesn't mean that, you know, that your house belongs to someone else now. And I think one thing about this conflict, a lot of people don't realize is, under the laws of war, since World War II, it's no longer lawful to obtain territory through military conquest. So we go into Iraq and we, you know, took over Iraq and militarily occupied it. That doesn't mean that can become American soil. If we had decided to annex that any part of Iraq to the United States, that's a war crime. And so a lot of people are like, oh, well, they won the war. They did this. That was hundreds of years ago, that's what we did. But after World War II, and because of World War II, we agreed as a world, the United Nations said that is not allowable anymore. So as it concerns the Palestinian refugees specifically, the UN General Assembly in 1948 in December, so about 7 months after Israel was formed, and they call it El Nakba, the catastrophe in Arabic, of these people being expelled from their lands, the UN said that refugees wishing to return to their homes and live at peace with their neighbors should be permitted to do so at the earliest practicable date, and that compensation should be paid for the property of those choosing not to return and for loss of or damage to property, which, under principles of international law or equity, should be made good by the governments or authorities responsible. So in other words, it said, if they were driven out by the war, they have a choice. They can come back or they can choose not to come back. But if they choose not to come back, the people who drove them out have to compensate them. Well, nobody's been allowed back and nobody's been compensated, not one person. So, and I should say that little blurb that I read you there, that's not binding law. It's like we have, like in America, we have like, oh, Congress passes a bill and there's a sense of the Congress resolution where it's non-binding. This would be kind of equivalent to a non-binding resolution in that context, but it accurately reflects the content of applicable international law.
So since it's non-binding,
I'm having a lawyer.
So since it's non-binding, then the refugees have no foot to stand on. Then, like they're not really a law.
It's what that resolution summed up. What would have been a little more complex worded in international law. So okay. It's an encapsulation, a summary of what more complicated law says is required. So
okay.
So what happens when they stand up for themselves with that?
Well, here's part of the problem. So you asked about
in your terrorist
state of Israel. They block that. They have not held up that UN resolution. They do not allow, as Steve said, not one single Palestinian has returned to their home, and not one single Palestinian has been compensated for the loss of their homes. So knowing that that's part of the root of this is important.
Right.
Okay. So when they don't have anything, and then the place where they have to flee to basically says, no, you're almost subhuman. You are definitely not a first class citizen. You're a third or fourth class citizen. You can't do this job. You can't own this property. You can't have a bank account. Things that we just don't even think about. I mean,
who's saying that? Is Palestine saying that, or is Israel saying that?
Saying what?
Or is that like they Jordan can't own saying
property
that,
yeah. or whatever?
when you are a refugee, you don't have the rights in the country. So when the Palestinian diaspora that is in Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan are not allowed those basic human rights.
So Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan are just simply saying you're not our people. You're second rate citizens.
They're not even second rate citizens.
So they have apartments? Do they sleep in tents? How are they living? Just in those camps you're talking about?
Yeah. So the refugee camps were, of course, started mostly 1948 and 1967 when the next influx came in. Of course, they were tents. And now they look like, it depends on which country you're in. But if you're in Beirut, you're in a very urban setting. So they're basically slums now. Okay. In Jordan, they're a little bit more deserty. How do I want to say it? Because
they're in the middle of the desert.
They're in the middle of the desert. And they have problems with, you want to talk about COVID, about a pandemic in a refugee camp. So one of the camps that I work in Shatila camp in central Beirut, it's less than a kilometer and it has over 30,000 inhabitants right now. Okay. Also, you don't have clean water provided for you. You actually have to buy water.
Or so, electricity, really, right?
Intermittent at best. So maybe 4 hours a day. Okay. So now with COVID, you have families living together in 1 to 2 room structures, 10 people, possibly 10 or more. So if somebody gets COVID, they can't socially distance. They can't. So then the whole family gets COVID. So that's been part of the problem with the pandemic that you're seeing, like in India and places that are densely populated, also with a lack of water. It's really, really, it's just added another layer of suffering. I mean, we've all suffered through it, but for marginalized groups that are that densely populated, it's bad.
So I have questions, obviously.
I bet you do.
What's the hope here? So do we need to have new legislation basically like giving refugees rights? Because like why do we think it's okay to say that refugees aren't human? Like when was that decided and how is everyone just okay with that?
Yeah, I mean, this is a hard, hard topic. What's the hope? I find hope in Palestinians themselves. I see so many of my Palestinian friends, like you think you're having a bad day, and I see what they get up every day and have to face, and they continue to do that. And they continue to just live in the face of that kind of oppression. I don't know, Steve.
I mean, on a political level, I am not hopeful. I mean, I just don't, I don't see it happening anytime soon that there's a viable political solution for the refugee situation.
I mean, the only way to do it maybe is make it a human rights. Cause I mean, like if enough people like woke up to like what was going on, I mean, like it could be any of us.
You'd have
to
get the Jordanian and Syrian government and all those people to actually do that kind of stuff. And I mean, I don't know how the United States influences those kind of countries like that.
But here's the thing. So why should, like, in each country, it's very, very complicated of why Palestinians are not citizens there. So why should those countries be expected to? It's like the same thing. Like, let's say we have a war in the United States, which maybe is not too far off. But what if we have a war and everybody's like, oh, we'll just go to Canada and Canada should take us all because we all speak English and we're all kind of the same. It's not really viable. Like in Lebanon, you have a very fragile religious makeup. You have a small Christian population right now. You have the majority are Shia Muslims, and then you have Sunni. So Palestinians are Sunni, okay? So if they get citizenship, they're gonna off the balance of power in Lebanon, who has the majority, then it'll be a Sunni. So you have different various reasons of why. And then there's that hope for different Arab countries, and they used the right of return also for not giving them citizenship. Like, no, they're supposed to go back. We're keeping Palestine alive. That kind
Haven't most of the people, though, that were displaced 70 some odd years ago, they probably passed by now. You know, and I'm not saying that their children shouldn't inherit their land or whatever it was they owned before Israel, you know, became a state or a country, rather. But, you know, are the people that are not born in Syria, for example, that are Palestinian refugees, do they not have a completely different identity, you know, as opposed to what their probably by now great grandparents have?
That's a good question.
Yeah, no, their identity is Palestinian because that's culturally speaking, there's differences between Syrian culture and Palestinian culture. They live in refugee camps in Syria. So they're confined to living in areas that are only full of the people who have a similar background.
Now, and to be clear, in Syria, before their civil war, Palestinians had more rights than they do in Lebanon and Jordan. Like, they were able to get an education and work legally. They still had refugee status, but so you have different problems in the different countries that they're in. Okay. They face different challenges, but yeah, like in Lebanon and in the camps, you know, that there's a Palestinian accent in Arabic versus a Lebanese accent. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's still very, they're still very culturally Palestinian. In Jordan, it's the same thing.
So there's a
go ahead.
I was just gonna say there's not a, because they're in their own communities, you know, they very much still identify with that. They still know that their only way they're ever going to get those rights of citizenship or to have a Palestinian state, or to get back, you know, something. Even though, you know, for most of them, frankly, there's little to no hope of recovering anything of their families that is in the area that is now the state of Israel.
Right.
So that's what they're entitled to under the law, and what they dream of is unfortunately very different from what is probably possible. Even under the best case scenarios, just there's too much in terms of the geopolitical forces at work. You know, countries like America and Germany in particular, and India now are very, very pro-Israel in terms of shielding the Israeli government, you know, in terms of actions that it might take that would be disadvantageous to Palestinians and in particular to the refugees.
I know we don't have a lot of time, and I know actually you guys really want to talk about the current situation in Israel, Palestine, and we've covered the diaspora, right, of Palestinian refugees. But, you know, Steve and I have been talking all week for him not being a good friend. we've been on the phone a lot this week, and we've both been on Twitter a lot, which Twitter is it's a cesspool, but it's an excellent source to get news of what's actually going on the ground. And I think part of what's so, I mean, it's painful to watch what's going on. It was painful for me, for someone that works with Palestinians, but, and I see what my Palestinian friends are going through right now. It doesn't matter if you are Palestinian American or Palestinian Canadian, they're hurting watching what's happening to their people. And I think we need to keep that in mind and be respectful. But, you know, we've been talking all week about, because everybody wants to talk about different things, but nobody's really talking about the occupation of the West Bank. And I think that's important, because I think until that piece, until you have the right of return of Palestinian refugees, until we figure out what we're doing with, until they get basic human rights, right, and citizenship. And actually, so many of my Palestinian friends are like, citizenship's not the thing. We want basic rights. We want the basic rights you have. But until we like actually address the occupation of how long? It's been since 67.
Oh, since 67, 53 years.
53 years. this is going to continue. So it's not a surprising thing of what's happening. Unfortunately, this is going to continue because we haven't dealt with the actual oppression of Palestinians that are still in Palestine.
Well, it's so not like Palestine refugees are the ones that are, you know, tossing missiles over at the Iron Dome or anything. Like, so I mean, you know, when we talk about Palestine and Israel conflict, as far as that goes, that doesn't really have much to do with the refugees, except for the fact that the refugees are a product of Israel, correct?
Except that the majority,
just the right of return ones, yeah, or something like that.
Well, but except that the majority of the population in Gaza are refugees, yep, and they're trapped in there without basic rights. And so with 4 hours of electricity a day, with, I mean, 90% of their water is undrinkable in Gaza. And now you're watching the operation going down. And Steve and I both, if you go through Twitter, we've seen horrendous footage of children dying, of just the misery and the inflict. I mean, how they've inflicted even more suffering. And so remembering that those people are refugees is incredibly important, because when people say Gaza, they say Hamas. Mm-hmm. And so you can dehumanize a refugee by just saying Hamas instead of realizing who actually lives in Gaza.
And people just seem to think, I think they're like, hey, if you're in Gaza, you're Hamas. And while the numbers are kind of uncertain, they're difficult to ascertain because Gaza is the way it is. I mean, the indications are that the support for Hamas is roughly about 20% in Gaza at this point. It's very, very low. There's incredible dissatisfaction, but there's not been an election for anybody to replace them. Because they control whether or not that happens. So you've got a low support among the population for the group that is, you know, launching these rockets.
But if you, Americans just get really stuck on Hamas, and they get stuck on, I was talking to maybe it was you earlier. No, it was you, because I was like, Americans are very generous, especially when there's a tragedy, right? Like when the Beirut blast happened last year, people just gave generously to us, and we were able to like get some stuff done there and provide things, because people want to help people are contacting me about Gaza too. Like what can we do? Americans are very generous, but there's something about marginalized people. And Omar and Elizabeth, I think you can relate to this as Christians being in missions years ago, right, and coming out of it. But marginalized people and the poor have to be pristine. They have to be worthy. They have to be good enough to get our help and our compassion. And I think when you just say Hamas, you can dehumanize an entire Palestinian population to where they don't deserve help and they don't deserve our compassion. And I think that's what I've seen working with Palestinians over the years. That's what I've seen, which makes me want to like break down and cry right now. Instead of realizing who they are as people, what they're lacking in basic human rights, and why aren't we fighting for them just to have the same rights that we have and to live in safety and security?
Yeah, that goes back to my question about like the hope and like what is going to happen if we don't believe that there's enough incentive for these different countries or world powers to make the right decision, because when it always boils down to money, you know? And so like, if there's not enough incentive for them to see this large population of people as people, then it's almost like, is the next level of hope? And like you said, your hope is in the people themselves. So like a grassroots movement, like an awareness, whether it's through social media or what is it that like we could do to try to make things better? Like that's where I'm like,
education's the key. That's why I focus on it. I think when people understand, like I posted something on Facebook yesterday about the Nakba, because yesterday was the anniversary. Steve said it briefly. It means the catastrophe. So the day after the State of Israel celebrates its birthday, the Palestinians commemorate the Nakba, which means that they commemorate that they've lost their entire country every year. So, you know, it's, and people were responsive to what I had to say, because I just listed out some facts, like, because the Nakba didn't stop in 1948, it's continuing on with the refugee crisis, with the occupation, with Gaza. It happens daily for Palestinians.
I think that's what people don't tend to recognize as much about that, is that this isn't something that happened in the past. There's a very current reality that is driving the situation. When somebody says, like, well, they're launching missiles, I want to say, okay, use your head a minute and tell me, why would they be launching missiles? Well, because they hate them. Why might they launch missiles and hate them? And you have to go behind those two questions, and you look into the ground and you see that there is this dispossession, that there is this refugee problem, and that there's an ongoing growing dispossession. And I mean, under people don't like to use the phrase, but ethnic cleansing is the accurate legal term for what's been going on. And it's still going on.
Do you want to give them the legal definition of that?
Sure. Yeah.
Because it's a charged term, but when I teach, we are using it because it legally fits what's happening.
Can we clarify real quickly who we're talking about, though, when we say that? So you're saying that Israel is committing ethnic cleansing. Is that correct?
The state of Israel.
The state of Israel. So, and it's especially, and its connections to private settler groups.
Okay.
But ethnic cleansing is, under the United Nations definition, it's rendering an area homogenous, ethnically homogenous, by using force or intimidation to remove people from another ethnic or religious group. So, I mean, by displacing someone by saying, hey, with this, that we're going to declare. So one of the things the Israelis do in the West Bank is they'll take an area and they'll declare it as militarily important area or archaeologically important, and then they'll boot all the Palestinians off of it. And then, lo and behold, a few years later, there's some apartments built there.
Yep. So what we're seeing in East Jerusalem right now with Sheikh Jarrah, which is a Palestinian neighborhood, which it's in the Israeli Supreme Court right now, whether they're going to kick out, was it?
Six
families out of the neighborhood. So those families were placed in that neighborhood by the Jordanians in 1948 because they were displaced from their villages during the conflict. And now they're at risk of being displaced again.
And legally, the reason that happens is because the Israeli government passed a law that said any Israeli Jew who lost their home during the 1948 war, because there were Jews in Israel before 1948, a whole bunch of them. Excuse me. Any Jew who lost their home in that war can apply to get it back. In other words, hey, I lost my home in the war. I became a refugee. Even though the state of Israel won that war, there were Jews who became kind of displaced internally. And the law says they can go back and get their lost property. Well, there is no equivalent law if you are not a Jew. It applies only to Israeli Jews. Doesn't apply to Israeli Palestinian citizens. 20%, a lot of people don't know this, 20% of Israel is Palestinian ethnically, in terms of like citizenship inside their own borders. So it's the laws are problematic in a big way, and they do tend to reinforce the gradual demographic shift from Palestinian population to Israeli Jewish population.
So are you saying that Israel takes on Palestinian refugees? Is that correct?
No. So when the war happened in 1948, the land that was allotted for an Israeli state had Palestinians living on it. Hundreds of thousands of them fled the war. Some did not. Those who did not became citizens of the new Israeli state. And that's today 20% of the population. So it's a huge minority.
And they're treated as second-rate citizens, I imagine?
Yeah, it's not as bad as being a refugee or being in the West Bank, but there are definite problems with that. I mean, for instance, there's neighborhoods are off limits to you if you're not Jewish. Can't go buy a house there. Things like that. I mean, it's very reminiscent of Jim Crow in some ways.
That's really interesting. So,
I want to ask you more about the occupation. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, babe. I think you're...
No, go.
Up too. Or is it mine?
Yeah, it is. I don't know. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, babe. Please.
Well, I'm reading this book called Cast, The Origins of Our Discontents by Isabel Wilkerson.
Yes, it's so good, Elizabeth.
It is so good. I'm listening to the audio version. I am 90% through. And so like what you guys are saying, it just is fascinating to me because the author, what she did was she explains the caste system of the United States, but basically racism, and shows how what we would consider racism here in America is parallel to the caste system in India. Along with that, she shows how the Nazi Germans back in World War II used our caste system, our United States caste system, and how we set up our laws, the Jim Crow laws and whatnot. And they said, hey, this is a really good idea. Let's do this and we'll do it towards the Jews. And now here it's like the Jews are doing the same thing, essentially. Like this is a whole nother set of caste system.
Yeah, it's really
this one feels like more on a global scale almost, just because there are so many nations involved, and it almost feels like there's, like Omar is trying to ask, like, is there hope? How do we do this? Like it's going to take more than just one country changing their ideas of caste and breaking that all down to find some type of solution. Right.
I mean, yeah, let's just back up, because I think this is really charged what we're getting into now, because, you know, I always teach on transgenerational trauma when we talk about Palestinian refugees, or if I talk about how the conflict impacts them, because it goes both ways for the Israelis as well. And I think that when you have that much trauma, it's really, really hard to, your identity forms out of that. And so it's a charged topic. And I just, it's funny. Like I even had a conversation with someone today who turned out to be Jewish American. And when it was charged. And I think when she realized that I wasn't anti-Semitic. I wasn't ripping on the Jewish community. And I think that's really important, because I know I'm circling around because I'm just formatting what I want to say, because I want to be careful, because this is so painful for so many people involved, and people, especially the Jewish community here in the United States. Because anti-Semitism is on the rise, and we need to be really careful about that, about the Holocaust, about remembering all of that, and making sure that, you know, the Jewish community has a safe and secure place to live, but it also doesn't give them the right to just run rampant and take human rights away from another people group. And then that's where we need to hold them accountable in. But I think
a global thing though, that like a global group that needs to hold them accountable, or
I think the United States,
we're the only country with enough power to do it. And it will not happen until there's a substantial shift in public opinion that we would use our power to kind of change that situation or push for a change in it. Right now, there's just the voting power of white evangelicals is far too powerful, and they are the electoral force that drives that policy.
I want to touch on that just a second, if you don't mind. You said white evangelicals are kind of controlling the narrative here, and they're certainly in, you know, pro-Israel. Wouldn't you say, possibly, I don't know, that none of this would be an issue if religion weren't involved?
You know, it's not, I don't want to say it's not a religious conflict. Like, the origins of this is not religion.
Isn't it, though?
No, it's political.
I mean, it's kind of a crappy piece of land, right?
No, it's not, actually. That's the issue. It's not. But like, we talked a little bit about the beginning of it. It was political. It was colonialism. It was imperialism of Europe coming in and chopping up the Middle East for themselves. That's what we're talking about. And I think we always want to turn it, it's easier to turn it into a religious conflict. Like, Jews, Muslims, they hate each other. Actually, my Palestinian friends don't hate Jews. Okay, they just don't. But here, so let's turn it to the United States. Here, it might be more about religion, right? Because you have evangelical Christians that believe in dispensationalism, that, you know, the second coming of Christ will come, so we have to support Israel no matter what. And to me, I don't know if I should say this. Should I say it? I don't know.
Of course you should say it.
I'm going to say it. To me, that theology is another form of anti-Semitism, because you are using an entire people group as a means to an end to your theology. Like, it's not about wanting safety and security for them. It's not about actually knowing them. It's, they're an object. They're an object for your theology.
That's a nice,
I don't know. That's point. Probably the most controversial thing I've ever said.
I think the other thing to note is, I mean, Israel is among, and perhaps maybe the most secular society in the world. It's an incredibly secular state. I mean, you think about people in America talk about, like, oh, France, you know, religion's dead in France. There's no, it's France is more religious than, you know, Paris is more religious than Tel Aviv. It's, you know,
and the fact that, you know, they built the state of Israel on socialism.
Yeah. Secular socialism.
It's secular socialism.
A religious project.
It, you know, they built it. They had kibbutzes, which were communities where they would, that's how they built a modern day state. In the amount of time they did in the middle of the Middle East.
And it also goes back to, like, at the end of the day, why is there an ongoing conflict? It's not because there's a difference in religion, because you have Jewish Israelis and Muslim Palestinians, and as well as Christian Palestinians. A lot of people don't know this. There's over 100,000 Christian Palestinians in the Holy Land. Yeah. So, but, you know, that's not the issue. The issue goes back to the occupation. If there wasn't an occupation going on, would there still be problems with Muslim extremists? Yeah, absolutely. That would be a problem. But it's a whole different ballgame when there's an occupation going on and an entire people are dispossessed wholesale.
I'm glad you brought it back to the occupation, though, Steve, because that justifies me asking my question that I was going to ask like 10 minutes ago.
I'm here for you.
I appreciate it, man. We're on that level. So this is my question, because I think a lot of people, like you were saying, Suzanne, that, like, we don't really understand what that even means in America. Like, the idea. So do you have, like, maybe some personal stories of maybe some refugees that you know or something you can share who ended up losing their land or who were displaced like that and maybe have gone back to see that now, like, somebody else is living in their home or anything, any stories like that?
No, they haven't gone back. I mean, they haven't gone back. That's the issue. Like, they haven't gone back. And yeah, I have hundreds of stories. You know, when I go into a home in a refugee camp, I mean, Palestinians are really hospitable, and as a foreigner, they always welcome me in, and, you know, they'll ply me with cups, and they've done it with Steve too, with tiny cups of tea and coffee and sweets, and then they'll tell me what village they're from. They'll bring out keys,
maps
to their homes, maps, deeds.
You told us this beautiful Christmas story last time about how they came and, like, or maybe it was Thanksgiving. I don't remember, but either way, they gave you like a Western holiday.
Oh, that was, you know, it was good. It was a very good friend of mine whose family is Muslim. And I was alone there. It was a couple of years ago in Beirut. And her mother invited me, and I love her mother. Her mother invited me for Christmas, and they don't celebrate Christmas. And her mother actually went to one of the fancier grocery store chains. She's like, I know Christians eat turkey for Christmas. So she had a turkey ordered. And in Lebanon, it's a little bit different. They stuff it with chestnuts and stuff like that. And that's what they did for me as a guest. But they were Lebanese. So
and some of them do celebrate Christmas. We have a friend who's in Jordan, he was telling us that the majority of Christmas trees sold in Amman are purchased by Muslims, not the the small Christmas trees in Jordan.
Yeah. So I think when we're talking about Palestine, you know, they haven't gone back to see their home. That's the dream. That's what they tell their children. That's what they tell their grandchildren.
The reason I ask, I've been binging a podcast called Unsettled this week, and they get some amazing interviews with people, some of them being refugees and some of them being in political spheres and things like that. And so that's where I've been getting a lot of my education. And one man told the story, and I'm going to kind of retell it just because it helped me kind of understand more of like what the occupation like actually is, because this guy was talking about how he had this amazing orange orchard, right? Like where he lived and it was in Israel or whatever. And then when he was forced out, and the reason he chose to leave because the safety for his family. So it's like, it wasn't like they came to his house and like forced him out, but there was bombing going on. There was a lot of violence. And so he made the decision to leave, not knowing that he would never be able to come back. And so I guess it's one of the things where he got lucky, able to cross the border again, like years and years later, and went to his orange orchard and saw that there was a Jewish guy who was living there, like running the orchard and basically profiting off of all of his work and all of the different stuff. And so it's just like that. So putting that in like terms that maybe we can understand, because like being American, hardworking, you know, everything is mine, is that whole freedom mentality, you know, like, and to just be up and displaced from everything that you know that is yours, and now it belongs to somebody else, and you're just supposed to be okay with that and not want to heave fucking missiles at somebody.
You're just supposed to be okay with it, period. Like, you're not supposed to fight back. You're not supposed to raise a voice. You're just supposed to be okay with it. And we need to think about that.
And on top of that too, Sue, and you guys, Sue, you can talk more about this, because isn't there currently a 11 year, 12 year protest that's been going on, started out as a march. Like they were going to march back to get their land or whatever, but they've been held up at the Great March. And so like, and where that's become violent and stuff as well, but it's a peaceful movement for like 90% of it.
Yeah. There's before I forget, also the podcast Rethinking Palestine.
Okay.
Omar is really, really good. Really, really helpful. So I recommend that, but, there's lots of examples of nonviolent resistance in Palestine, in the West Bank, during the Intifadas. There's a great movie called The Wanted 18, and it's about Beit Suhoor, which is a Christian village near Bethlehem. And they were famous for nonviolent resistance, and one of the forms was to buy cows so they could have their own milk and not buy Israeli milk. So these are the kind of stories that we don't hear, because we have to make it dramatic and the violence sells. But there's example after example after example of nonviolent resistance for Palestinians as a viable means of fighting the occupation.
If you want to watch a good but definitely unsettling movie about this, Five Broken Cameras.
Yeah.
It's about a village that had weekly nonviolent protests in the West Bank and what happened there. I highly recommend it. I highly recommend not doing it before something where you're going to go be social.
Yeah.
It's a jarring movie, but it's very raw and real.
Well, that's interesting too, because I heard that has become a tactic that a lot of Palestinians are using, is instead of using weapons to fight back, they're fighting back with the camera. And like, it's like their defense, kind of like over here in the States with a lot of black people, like being oppressed by cops. Like they find like, you don't shoot back, but you bring out a camera, because that way anything that happens, you can show the oppression firsthand.
The phone is changing things. And I think that's, you know, it's been interesting. This is how many operations I've been through in Gaza. Like in 2009, I was in Lebanon. And the other thing you should keep in mind, if there's a Israeli military operation in Gaza, it affects all of the camps throughout the Middle East. So that was 2009, 2014. There was another massive one. And this time it feels a little different. This time I see more people speaking up. Like even just the protests, that the demonstrations that we saw in London, in Toronto, even in Denver, there was like 1,000 people on the streets supporting Palestinians. That is a little bit different than what I've seen over 17 years. And I accredit some of that. I credit some of that to the camera and the phone. Because
I was going
to
say, yeah, anytime you get the arts involved, like camera or whatnot, you're going to get people that are going to notice. And it seems to me like the church of, you know, the conservatives in this country are pro-Israel, and the church of the, you know, left
church of the conservatives. That sounds like a horrible church. I don't want to be a part of the church of the conservatives. What a name.
And the church of the leftists are pro-Palestine. It seems like that's kind of where it's going. So it's interesting.
Some are. There's a lot of liberals that are real uncomfortable with Palestine. Trust me, they're real uncomfortable with Palestinian narrative.
Yeah. And I think too. I mean, it's a little bit more. You'd be surprised, I think, at how many people are beginning to reconsider some of this. And some of that, I think, you know, Suzanne talked about the camera. I think the biggest thing ahead of the camera was Black Lives Matter in the U.S. That opened up a portion of the American public's mind to asking new questions and receiving new information about societal problems here. And it's really easy to kind of all of a sudden get news about Palestine and start asking the same questions and saying, wait a minute, like what's going on with Israelis and Palestinians? And I think that's not necessarily, I mean, I agree, certainly, you know, with Omar, it's largely right left in a lot of ways, but it's not entirely. I mean, I'm certainly not a leftist or anything close to it. I mean, I was a registered.
He's a lawyer.
I was a registered Republican my whole life until they nominated Donald Trump in 2016.
That'll do it.
So, I mean, so it's hard. It's I would not call it an ideologically monolithic movement.
Yeah.
But Chris is also right, though, as far as like a lot of the mainstream news media, depending on which one you're listening to, will spin it either pro-Israel or the whole free Palestine.
There's not a lot of pro, like even NPR, you guys, I get real frustrated with the news cycle here, because it's not just Fox News. CNN does not do a good job. NPR does not do a good job. Even I was watching BBC yelling at the TV the other day, watching the BBC Nightly News, because it's very slanted.
And I would add that, like, for your listeners too, I mean, right now, Al Jazeera English is hitting it out of the park. If you've got a smart TV, Amazon Fire or Roku, download the Al Jazeera English app, and their selection of programs is just, they have some really good coverage, like 25-minute spots on what's happening over there. It's really useful. And they're editorially, they're a different animal than the Al Jazeera Arabic that we used to hear about a lot during the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. But they do a pretty good job. It's impressive.
Is that not the building that was just blown up over there?
It was AP, wasn't it?
It was Al Jazeera and AP. AP. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Wow. And apparently other organizations as well. The irony of that, the guy who ran the AP office there, like the day before, tweeted something along the lines of, you know, at least, you know, the Israeli army knows where our office is, and I can always go back there, and I feel like this is at least one place where I'm safe. And then they gave him an hour's notice, and they said, we're going to come in, empty the building out. Al Jazeera lost about half of their video and photo archives in that. They were only able to get part of it out. There's video floating around on Twitter of the building's owner pleading with Israeli military folks, just give us 10 more minutes, and they wouldn't do it.
There's got to be something to erasing all that media that's beneficial for the Israeli narrative there, I would think.
I mean, yeah, I mean, I hesitate to draw conclusions about their motives, because there could be a lot of motives. Some are multiple nefarious ones. There could be some good ones in there. I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say, well, just because they did it and it appears really bad, that doesn't mean that Hamas didn't have, you know, an office stuck in the basement or something. That just means we have to ask other questions about international law and the laws of war. But it's hard to take a lot of stuff at face value in this situation.
Well, did we cover it all?
I think Omar's trying to say stuff, but he's muted.
Oh, you can keep going. No, it's fine. Yeah, you covered it all. This has been a really good conversation. Unless you have, you know, friends who spent 17 years in the Middle East, like we're lucky enough to have. Thanks for coming on and speaking with us. Thanks for giving us different resources that we could check out. We will have those in the show notes. I saw Elizabeth writing them down as we were going.
Can I do a little add too? Because 100%, we're running in June 8th, we start running our classes online called Palestinian Refugees 101. And we'll go more in depth on the history, on the everyday life of a refugee. One of my friends who was displaced in Beirut, who now lives in America, will be doing a whole Q&A session so you can engage a Palestinian, what it's like to be a refugee. And then we'll talk about COVID in the future. So I can give you the link, but if you just go to beirutandbeyond.org, you'll find the page and you just need to register. Classes are free.
And what was the dates on that?
June 8th, they run biweekly for 4 classes.
Awesome. Very cool. Yeah. Thanks so much for doing this again. And I learned a whole lot. Steve, it was great meeting you. Thanks for putting up with us. And I mean, I know some of the questions may not have been very highbrow, but I'm really, really interested in this. And I think that like our listeners, it's a perspective that we really don't get a whole lot unless you are actually actively searching it out. And that's one thing I would encourage people to do. If they heard something here they're not sure about, research it on your own, go find other sources. Now's the time where there's so much information out there, whether it be like, you know, like she said, Twitter's a cesspool, but it's firsthand accounts a lot of times. And so maybe step outside your comfort zone, get some other information. But I appreciate this a whole lot.
I love that. I love that you mentioned that the mainstream media is having a really hard time of getting it right, because they're all about sensationalism, and you know, now that Donald Trump is not in office, they need something to get those headlines, to get those readers in there, and so they're going to do their best to try to, you know, use this to their advantage, and it's kind of sick, but anyhow, Beirut and Beyond.
I just think it's a good thing to have in the back of your mind when you're listening to a news report that has anything to do with Palestinians. Just think about the context. Think about the context. Think about what the agenda is. It's really, really important.
And Alan, if you mentioned this, follow Beirut and Beyond's Facebook page. There's regular updates on there. There's great information. There's opportunity to get in touch with us. And you know, if you want to ask questions, you know, we provide a lot of teaching resources throughout the year in terms of events where you can pick up some stuff firsthand and Q&A. So we welcome that.
It's awesome.
Yeah, it's been great. And there was more questions and we could have got into like more definitions of, you know, like what even Hamas was. So maybe down the road we can, if there's
a delicious dip made from garbanzo beans.
Yes, with lots of garlic.
Oh, that's hummus.
Oh my goodness.
Oh, you guys, now it's time for us to sign off.
Well, thank you once again. And Steve, it's nice meeting you. And to our listeners, peace.